This is going to be a panel discussion where we're going to be looking at some of the upcoming issues with ethanol, both here in the Heartland and in the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Talk about E15 and some of the other legislation that's in play right now. I'm going to turn this discussion over to Tom Bias, CEO of Growth Energy. Tom?
Well, thanks, Chris, and thank each of you for taking time. You know, I've been to a lot of farm shows and fairs in my life, and about this time of the day, everybody's looking for an open seat, so I can understand why people came in here. We're honored to have Secretary Northey with us today, and just basically what we want to do, and I think Bill agrees with me, it's most important to have your input on this stuff, because I tell folks this all the time. Anyone that comes from Washington and tells you they have the answers to all the challenges and the opportunities that we face in rural America, hold on to your wallet and your watch. And because the real answers to those and solutions lie with the people that live and work out here. And it's indeed an honor to be back out in Iowa again and have that opportunity for an exchange of ideas and what we need to be doing. And we'll kind of give a little update, or I will at least, on what I see happening or not happening in Washington. And the emphasis probably is on the not happening. As any of you have been following the media, Washington's pretty much in a stalemate. And it's not because there aren't great ideas or there are not great needs to move forward, but it's a very politically competitive town. And both political parties want to win this next election. It's like Iowa State playing Iowa in football. Neither side wants to see the other team score any points, with the election so close at hand. So the opportunity for bipartisan working relationships, it's not the most conducive at this time. Hopefully that changes after the elections. They're going to have a lame duck session. Senator Reid has already scheduled it for November 15th in the Senate. And we don't know then. We've got a lot of pending issues affecting our industry, as you know. We have regulatory issues, the E15 waiver decision, which is absolutely vital to our industry because the 10% blend wall basically says that the federal government is mandating that we use 90% gasoline, petroleum-based gasoline, in our fuel, and only 10% renewable. We know we can produce more than that. We're currently doing it. We don't have a production problem. We have an access to a bigger market problem. Raising the blend wall from E10 to E15 is the equivalent of adding about 130,000 new jobs here in America, places like Iowa and the Midwest, jobs that can't be outsourced. So it's vital for our economy. It also is vital for farm income. If you look at the ever-increasing yields that are occurring, and I've been to most of the seed and chemical companies' displays today, and bigger yields are coming down the road, and we all know we can produce more, but we're going to have a market for it. And moving to E10 to E15 is the equivalent of reducing our dependence on foreign oil by 7 billion gallons a year. That's the equivalent of saying to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, we're not buying your oil anymore. You know, next month, or maybe it's this month, is the 50th anniversary of OPEC, which was an oil cartel set up, which has basically made our nation and most of the developed countries in the world dependent on a very handful of market-controlled oil-producing countries that don't necessarily have our country's interest at heart. So that E15 decision is critical. EPA has indicated, and DOE has indicated, the tests on the 2007 and newer cars will be complete this month, by the end of this month, and that the tests on 2001 and newer vehicles will be completed in November. DOE is not testing anything other than E15. They're not testing E12. They're not testing E13. They're testing E15 and E20. Ironically, a higher number than we all applied the waiver for. EPA and DOE, or EPA, has been very clear from the start that they don't think the data that we submitted when we filed the waiver from public and independent sources is enough for them to make the decision. They want independent government testing of it. And that's why they're hesitant to make a decision, and we've had all these delays until those DOE tests are concluded this fall. I will tell you, everyone says privately that there have been no red flags raised by any of the testing, either on E15 or E20, which proves what we submitted. So we're very hopeful we'll get it. Will we get it for all vehicles? If I were betting, I would say no. And the reason is the small engine manufacturers and the boat owners and the auto industry have all raised a lot of ruckus over granting higher blends without independent government testing. And as I told you, thus far that isn't happening. Ironically, and this is kind of a funny one to me, DOE says it's tough to test older cars. They can't find any 20-year-old cars without a lot of miles on it. Well, hello, you know, what would you expect? So anyway, we have our challenges, but we have to keep in mind, even if it's a bifurcated decision, that decision will have to turn and make it work. It's voluntary. E15 is voluntary. It's going to take a big marketing effort to convince consumers and retailers that it's better, just like it did for E10. It took from 1978 to today to get saturation of E10. It's not going to happen overnight. We're going to have to work at it, whether it's for a handful of cars, a majority of the cars, or all the cars. Quickly, on the legislative front, we've been working really hard on what we see as the biggest challenge. We just had a little explanation of the E15 fiasco, or the waiver fiasco, and how difficult it is to get that decision in a timely manner and get to where we want to be. What we've been advocating is what we call our Fueling Freedom Plan, which basically says, let's mandate that all cars sold in America are flex fuel capable. It costs less than $100 at the manufacturer. It would give us the ability to sell higher blends, mid-level blends, all the way up to E85 for any auto in America. And the second component, because the autos say, well, we'd build more if we had more fueling stations. And the retailers say, well, we don't want to invest money into retailing infrastructure unless there's the cars to burn it. And so we're saying, guys, join hands, walk forward together. We want to see incentives to put blender pumps at every retail station in America, nationwide, 200,000 within 5 years. Our opportunity to get anything like this and an ethanol pipeline and getting rid of the corn discrimination clause and getting rid of the most bizarre concept ever, indirect land use, depends upon the Senate moving an energy bill. Senator Reid announced yesterday they are going to attempt to move one in the lame duck session, which is November the 15th. He also announced that he is now adding renewable electricity standard. So if anyone ever tells you it's too late in the legislative process, that is not reality, because that process is a fluid process. It changes daily, and it can happen. So we have to keep pushing for that. At this time, I'll turn it over to the Honorable Secretary of Agriculture, a great advocate for ethanol, a great advocate for farmers, and a great friend, Bill Northing.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Again, welcome to everybody to Iowa. Thank you all for being here. Certainly thank you for being here for this important topic. You know, we've got certainly a great productivity possible here in the state of Iowa. We've got some awful good-looking corn that you came across. And as Tom pointed out, those yields keep growing. They're certainly a lot different than what they were 30 years ago when I started to farm. And we need ethanol to be able to use up some of that corn. That's what started ethanol, was in the 1980s. Farmers said, we're tired of $1.50, $1.30 corn prices, and we're going to build an industry to use up some of the surpluses that we produce every year, knowing we're going to produce more every year. And actually, the ethanol industry has done exactly what it said that it would do, what corn farmers said it would do. and that would grow slowly, use up some of that production, become more efficient over time. And we actually have ethanol plants right now that are producing ethanol, selling ethanol for less than the cost of gasoline. And that's before the tax credit. We got $1.60. I talked to a plant manager yesterday who said they sold a batch just the other day for $1.62 of ethanol. That's cheaper than wholesale gasoline is. Then that's get blended with gasoline, and the blender takes the 45 cents and reduces the cost of that final fuel. Certainly we need some of those incentives to continue. We need some predictability. We need more than 3 months predictability with those incentives going off here in December. We need a longer-term vision of what can happen out here. But the industry is doing the right things. Corn growers are doing the right things by raising more corn as well. And right now, we're using 4 billion bushels of corn to produce ethanol out of the 13 billion we produce. And frankly, some of the stuff out here wouldn't be happening. Some of the things that you walk past right now wouldn't be happening without the demand that we've had for ethanol. You look at that demand and what that means for Iowa farmers. One set of numbers, we have an ag census that's done every 5 years. The ag census, the sales from our farms in Iowa in 2002 was $12 billion. Half of that crops, half of that livestock. 5 years later, in 2007, the sales from those farms was $20 billion. I tell you, the biggest change between 2002 and 2007 was the amount of corn that went to ethanol. And that created lots of things, certainly helped in prices, certainly been very aggressive in increasing our yields as well. We have more livestock production because of distiller's grain. It has been good for the state of Iowa, and Iowa has a lot at stake in the policies that are decided in these next few months in Washington, D.C. So huge increase, $8 billion increase. Just for perspective, for those that are non-Iowans here, we have about 3 million people in Iowa. We have a state budget, a general fund budget in the state of Iowa that's $6 billion. Agriculture grew in sales $8 billion in 5 years, in a large part due to ethanol production. Certainly, we do not want to put that ethanol production at risk. We have 40 ethanol plants in Iowa, produce about 3 billion gallons of ethanol in Iowa. In total, in our gasoline-powered vehicles out here, we use 1.5 billion gallons of gasoline and ethanol. We produce twice as much ethanol as we use in gasoline and ethanol right now. So we're doing those things that we said we wanted to do, create a real alternative to oil out there. We're doing it in an efficient way. Those efficiencies are continuing to gather. Now we need more access to markets. And we need to be able to access more than the 9% or almost 10% of the market that we're in right now. We need to be able to get to 15% of that market. We also need predictability. We need policy that's going to be around for several years that everybody can understand. Frankly, at the end of the day, I think this is even more than about ethanol. It'd be enough if it was just about ethanol and corn farming and Iowa economics. But I think it's about the whole future of renewable fuels. Everybody else that potentially looks at renewable fuels down the road, investors in cellulose ethanol or whatever other kinds of alternatives to oil, are going to say, look at what happened in 2010. You know, the government did the right thing, continued that industry growing. Therefore, we believe we can invest in our alternatives as well. But if the alternative happens and the industry stumbles because of a change in government policy or folks that are not willing to pass those incentives, I'd certainly think there'd be some of those investors and some of those other alternative technologies that would sit back and say, well, it looks like the folks that have always done this, that had control of the industry, were able to choke off another competitor, and why in the world do I think mine's unique? So I think we have a lot at stake. We certainly have a lot at stake in the economics. We have a lot at stake that's up and down these streets out here, our farmers as well. But we have, I believe, in some ways, it's always been true in ethanol, but in some ways we have the whole stake of renewable energy alternatives to oil that are at stake in these next few months as well. So this is a very, very important issue to us. We need to be able to grow that infrastructure as well, because we are now to the place where we are producing ethanol for less than the price of gasoline. As we continue to be more efficient, we'll be able to compete head-to-head with gasoline without potentially incentives if government policy allows us to do it. If we can use more than 10% in our vehicles, if we don't have this 90% mandate of gasoline, if we're allowed to grow that market because a consumer can walk up to a pump or drive up to a pump with their flex fuel vehicle, they could use 85% ethanol and find a tank that's willing to pump 85% or 20% or 50%, whatever percent they're after, they need to be able to have access. But as right now, we have government policy that restricts that from happening. So certainly an important issue, important to Iowans. I appreciate you being here and look forward to questions and discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Northey. Thank you, Tom. There's clearly a lot of issues on the table here, a lot before the industry, a lot before agriculture. Before we go to questions from the press, I just want to cover one thing. One of the things that Growth Energy is doing here at Farm Progress is we are recruiting members to what we call our Growth Force. We have 18,000 individual people who have signed up for Growth Energy to join us in our advocacy for ethanol. As I said before, Growth Energy is the largest ethanol advocacy organization in the country. We have 65 ethanol plant members. I want to recognize some of our members who are here today. We've got Joel Jarman from Poet Hudson. We've got Rick Suri from Poet Chancellor, if you can raise your hand. And then Wade Wicken from CenterPoint, an associate member. So thanks for coming here. So we're going to turn to questions. We have a microphone here in the center of the walkway here. If anybody has any questions, just stand up and identify yourself, and we'll do our best. Thank you.
I'm not the press. My name is Tim Burak. I'm a farmer from Northeast Iowa. This is going to be a policy question, and this is a bitch, too. And I'll, if you give me just a minute to explain why it's a bitch.
Those are our favorite. Go ahead. Yeah.
4 years ago, I invested $25,000 into a biodiesel plant in the state of Iowa, along with other biodiesel plants I invested in and three ethanol plants. A year ago, the biodiesel tax credit wasn't renewed, and this is a policy question. Well, we all know that that's put severe hardship. We lost the jobs, etc., shut the industry down. Well, this last Friday, this 25,000 or this 60 million gallon plant went under. The board of directors resigned, handed the keys back to the bank. Now that plant's gone. Everybody that put money in that plant is gone. We all put our money in that plant because of policy that said we're going to have a dollar biodiesel tax credit. And it's, you know, it's my question now is that was my bitch. The policy changed, our investment, not only are the jobs gone, now the capital's gone. Now everybody's running scared, and how many other biodiesel plants are going to suffer? At the end of this year, the ethanol tax credit, the VTEC expires, the tariff goes off. You talk about correct policy. I'm starting to become very concerned about what's going to take place at the beginning of the coming year now with my ethanol industry, and will we be able to move forward, or will we be starting to suffer some of the very same things that the biodiesel industry is now undergoing, which is not pleasant at all anymore. And I'm looking for my banker, and I don't see him in here. He don't know it yet.
Tom,
thank you, Tim. I think you articulated a concern that everyone in the ethanol industry has been following. The biodiesel tax credit, as we all know, is a very helpful product to get the biodiesel industry started, basically. I mean, you know, it's not as mature even as the ethanol industry. And one of the challenges that they've had since December of last year is how to get that legislation extended. And in 2009, you had several tax packages, tax proposals that expired. Congress said at the time, almost everyone, they're not controversial, we're going to do it. Well, they didn't do it by December 31st, and they said, no problem, we'll do it when Congress comes back after the first of the year, we'll make it retroactive to the first of the year, and the biodiesel guys and everyone else will get it. That didn't happen. January became February, became May, became June. Every vote on extending those tax packages got a lower number of votes than the previous time. And in the Senate, it takes 60 votes. You can forget about the 50-vote majority because all anyone has to do is say, I'm going to filibuster this and talk it to death. And in order to overcome a filibuster, you have to invoke cloture, which is a term that basically says you need 60 votes, not a majority of 50. Every vote on the package kept going backwards. It fell 15 votes short, which wasn't even a simple majority the last time they voted for it, not because of the content, but because of other factors. This member didn't like the fact that they were paying for the offset in cost of extending a tax credit with cutting some other program. It was a variety of excuses and reasons, so it didn't happen. The biodiesel tax credit was part of 2009. In 2010, the VTEC expires, and the as does the ethanol tariff, a secondary tariff on Brazil. But there's a lot even more expensive tax credits that expire at the end of that year, which are known as the Bush tax credits of 2001 and 2003, including the estate tax, which is set, if it doesn't get extended, to go back to the 1990 levels and very high tax on estate. The alternative minimum tax, which is one that everyone has to pay if you're in a certain category, because years ago some very rich people were bypassing all taxes paid, period. Of course, Exxon did that last year, but they haven't nailed them. But anyway, that was the alternative minimum tax. That will affect 20-some million Americans. Those are pretty high up in the priority in the queue list. But what's going to happen in Washington is the Democrats are going to propose extending those tax credits for everyone except the wealthy. And the Republicans have pretty much, to a person, said, we're going to oppose any tax increases at all. So if you don't extend that tax credit, it's a tax increase. So we're back to stalemate until after the election. We've been worried about the VTEC when we started following what happened to the biodiesel tax credit this winter. That's why we came up with some creative ideas to as alternatives, because ultimately the best bet for the ethanol industry is to have a bigger, broader market. We're all for extending the VTEC for as long as we can get it, for as much money as we can get it, but the industry's future is in the marketplace. We don't have a problem producing ethanol. We have quite the opposite. We're like farmers. You know, Al Pell and I don't know where Al went. Our farms are 20 miles apart back in Indiana. We don't have that problem of not producing enough corn or soybeans. We have a problem of getting a decent price because we don't have a marketplace. And it's the same thing the ethanol industry is facing. And, Tim, everybody's on needles and pins about this. So if you see these politicians, tell them, work together. Let's get it extended. Bill?
Let me just add, too, I think it's been a travesty what's happened in the biodiesel industry. You watch, you got folks out there, most of the biodiesel plants in Iowa were built by small investors, gathered together, looked at what happened to the ethanol industry and the success, and said, this is an alternative. This is next generation. These are great opportunities. And believed, as most everybody said, that dollar a gallon tax credit was going to continue. Yes, it had a sunset, but it's had a sunset many times, and it's always continued. No one believed that was not going to continue. No one said that was not going to continue. And then it created a situation where we've seen, I've heard of another plant just actually today that in the last month has declared bankruptcy and have been turned back, and all the investors lost their money, and the bank owns it and certainly has a loss on it as well. It has been a huge problem. We used to brag about the biodiesel industry in the state of Iowa, the largest biodiesel industry of any state as well. We need to be able to get that back going again. And the real problem is is certainly, in some ways, the politics around this whole thing. Senator Grassley was asked the same question last night and said, actually, in some ways, biodiesel, many of these tax credits have been too popular. And so they're looked at as the engine to pull unpopular pieces through Congress. Now, I'm not sure we can always say that always about the ethanol industry and the ethanol tax credits and incentives, because we have some opponents out there. But for the most part, politics didn't work, because if you took a poll, most of the folks were for the biodiesel tax credit. And it did not happen, and we are now in September, and it still hasn't happened. And there have been real economic losses, real job losses, and I think, as you suggest, real confidence losses in what that means. Those investors that lost money are likely to be real reticent about investing money in other projects out there. We certainly don't want anything like that within the ethanol industry, and there is a lot of nervousness. We need some predictability. I think we have a chance. There are some things that are being talked about. I think there's some discussion about what might come about in this next few months, and we should be able to have something happen. But again, we saw something that should have happened over this last year, and it hasn't happened. So it's a really tough situation in the biodiesel business, and we don't want that same kind of situation in ethanol business, and we're talking even multiple the impact on the ethanol side.
Thanks, Bill. More questions?
Hi there, I'm Rick Suri. I manage an ethanol plant in South Dakota. I'll pull it to Chancellor, by the way. There's a popular misconception out there about how much ethanol is subsidized. Can you talk to the economics of it? I tell you, that's such a misconception in the world today. And tell these folks what actually does for the economy in rural America and the United States.
Rick, I think you hit the nail on the head, and I was sitting here listening while Bill was talking. You know, last year, earlier this year, there was a recent report. The oil industry in 2009 received over $500 billion in tax subsidies. Now, we're talking $5 billion a year on VTEC, which actually doesn't go directly to the ethanol industry. And $1 billion on the biodiesel tax credit at the top end, and compared to what a more mature industry in the oil industry receives. And you know, tax credits are not necessarily a subsidy in how they're designed. You know, people get a tax credit for their home mortgage, what they pay on their home mortgage. It's like beauty. It's kind of in the eye of the beholder. If you're getting it and I'm not, I'm going to say it's a subsidy, and vice versa. And that's one of the big challenges we face. But we've seen a very organized effort to stop ethanol in its tracks. It started in the 2007 Energy Act when they put in that international indirect land use and a corn discrimination clause that basically says we're going to cap you guys at the most 15 billion gallons. You're not guaranteed 15 billion. We saw it in the RFS2 rule. Instead of pitting renewable fuels against foreign oil, the new rule pits ethanol against ethanol. It's all designed to stop our industry, and it's probably because of the success of each of you. And Rick, you guys producing and the efficiency with less energy, less water. No one ever thought we could produce 12 billion gallons. No one thought that. It caught a lot of folks by surprise. And as General Wes Clark, who, you know, is involved with Growth Energy, reminds me all the time, he said, Tom, they're going to come after you guys because you're trying to take market share from the most well-established and richest corporations in America. And 10% is 10% that we took from them. 15% will come from them. So they've made up a lot of pretty good lies out there, food versus fuel, indirect land use, you name it, everything but premature hair loss. You know, in 2008, I used to have this top 10 list of all the most ridiculous criticisms. We heard everything from we caused tortilla protests in Mexico, even though tortillas are down there made out of white corn, not yellow corn. We've caused pasta riots in Italy, even though pasta is produced from durum wheat and some very microclimates of the United States and elsewhere. We caused toothpaste prices to go up because of the demand for phosphate for corn production. We caused movie prices to go up because of the increased price of popcorn. You know, give me a break. The one thing, and the one they missed, and I'm surprised they missed it, was right before Halloween, not blaming us for canceling trick-or-treat because of the price of candy corn went up because of Halloween.
And I think probably most folks understand here, but that VTEC, that tax credit that goes for ethanol, 45 cents a gallon. Remember, it started off, used to be 54 cents a gallon, went to 50 cents a gallon. Now it's 45 cents a gallon. You don't get a check for that. You sell your ethanol pre-tax credit from your ethanol plants. That then is sold to a blender. That blender, once they blend it with gasoline, gets that 45 cents a gallon, and at least right now is not really reflected in the price. Back to Tom's comment, it's ethanol plant against ethanol plant right now that's affecting what that price is, that $1.60 or so a gallon. Certainly it's not 45 cents higher because of a 45 cent tax credit. A lot of that's getting absorbed, either goes all the way to the final product or that blender, the oil industry itself, is getting the majority of that tax credit and not getting it passed through. Certainly not being passed up to the ethanol plant.
Hi, I'm Dan Looker with Successful Farming, and I almost hate to ask this question.
You're going to anyway.
Anybody but Dan got a question?
Right. Once powerful people like former Florida Governor Jeb Bush didn't like the ethanol tariff. And you haven't said very much about it. What do you see happening with that? Is that going to be renewed, or are there some threats to that, too?
I see no appetite in Congress for anyone getting rid of the tariff. You know, you talk about the 2007 Act was named the Energy Independent Security Act for America, and replacing foreign oil with foreign ethanol does not make this country any more energy secure. The VTEC and the tariff used to be parallel and coordinated. And basically, the purpose of the secondary tariff is to offset that taxpayers would not subsidize production of blending of foreign ethanol. In the 2008 Farm Bill, Congress, in their eminent wisdom, took out reduced the VTEC. I'm joking there about the wisdom part. They reduced the VTEC and but they kept the tariff at the same level, so there's about a 9 cent spread. And while Brazil talks about, you know, how unfair this whole thing is, they were offsetting, and that was the purpose of them, because I don't think anyone wants to spend taxpayer money subsidizing an industry overseas that competes with our industry, especially when that industry doesn't have to meet the same labor, health, safety, environmental standards that our ethanol plant members here do in producing ethanol here. If you're going to compete, compete on a level playing field, but they don't. Anyone else?
Hi, Joel Jarman, Poet by Refining Hudson, South Dakota. Tom, if you would, a little bit, if you could touch base on our Fueling Freedom Plan through Growth Energy and what that's going to do for us. I mean, as Americans, we tend to be have short memories. And, you know, without that access, that market access, and the ability to have research and development both within ethanol, research and development within seed companies, the impact on farm families, that type of thing. If that growth is stymied, oil embargoes aren't that far away. Everybody's going to be looking for ethanol. Farm aid hasn't been that far away. Everybody's going to go, what can we do for the farmers? It's funny how it goes in a vicious circle. And I know with that, we're trying to get away from the politics and just say, give us market access. Give the consumer options out there. So if you could, touch base a little bit about that and how all that ties together, I'd really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Jason. You know, the whole concept behind the Fueling Freedom Plan was what's the biggest challenge the industry faces? And it, again, it wasn't producing ethanol. We knew we can produce it. Matter of fact, we can overproduce it. It was having access to a bigger, broader market. And if you look at a lot of the criticisms of ethanol out there today, whether they're fact or fiction, and there's a lot of fictional criticisms that we are all well aware of, everyone always talks about this industry has been subsidized forever. It's time to stand on its own. This industry has to have a mandate and a subsidy. This industry can't produce enough to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And it became very clear, you got to address the biggest challenge we face, and that's access to a marketplace. And ethanol is the most competitively priced fuel in the world. We can compete if we have access to a marketplace. And that plan is really pretty simple. We didn't give specific details on how everything's going to be implemented. We wanted all our friends within the industry and the advocacy groups to weigh in. But let's set a goal, and what we articulated, that within 5 years, we could have a sufficient number of flex fuel vehicles on the road by mandating that beginning in 2012, 50% of all cars produced be flex fuel vehicle, and ratcheting up to 90% within 5 years. We picked a number of how many fueling stations to have blender pumps. And there's 166,000 gas stations or retail stations in America, and about 700 and some thousand pumps. Well, we figured that if you had more than enough blender pumps to cover every station, the competition, because as we've all heard, ethanol is cheaper than gasoline. The competition within those stations would force everyone to change. And we figured it costs about $25,000 per pump to install a blender pump times 200,000. That's $5 billion. That's $1 billion a year in infrastructure development that helps get us off of foreign oil. And as industry, we leapfrog the blend wall. We no longer have to worry about a waiver process with EPA. Because we'll have direct access to the market and to the autos that can burn it. And if you look at the history of this nation, investment into infrastructure has been sound public policy. Railroads, bridges, highways, interstate, airports, locks and dams, the internet, you name it. They're investing in the infrastructure. And a lot of talk about any energy policy is going to invest in battery technology for hybrids. It's going to invest in converting semis so they can burn natural gas for the T. Boone Pickens plant. So we think that's in line with public policy and an appropriate need to be able to do it. There's probably four or five possible legislative options, Jason, that could occur in the next couple of months. We want to be prepared. We want to advocate for the industry. We want that to move forward. Because you can't build out the infrastructure overnight. It's going to take a few years. And we figured a concentrated effort over a five-year period gets us well on the way. And then we can operate. We can absolutely operate. You guys have taught me well. You can operate in a free market.
Tom, I talked to you earlier about this, and my name's Gary Young. I'm president of Biothermal Energy. And what I looked at is a...
Put it a little closer, Gary.
Okay. What I was looking at, for example, as a chemical engineer, I said, what about new technologies where we can look at corn ethanol plants and look at them, how can we make them more efficient? One thing I looked at was the effluent gas coming off your corn ethanol fermenters, which is carbon dioxide. Now, this carbon dioxide gas is about 98% carbon dioxide and about 2% other hydrocarbons. And if you took this carbon dioxide and said, hey, that's a raw material, and if I ran it through a gasifier and converted that carbon dioxide to a syngas, which is carbon monoxide and hydrogen, then I can use that to make more ethanol. And by my computations and what I've done over the last 3 or 4 years, is I've computed that we can make about 70% more ethanol from a corn to ethanol plant by utilizing the carbon dioxide as a raw material. And by doing this, for example, if you had a 100 million gallon per year ethanol plant, by my estimates, and I believe they're conservative, you can produce another 70 million gallons per year of ethanol. And I estimated, by my computations, that the total manufacturing cost is about $1.03 a gallon. And right now, you get a corn to ethanol plant that begins to shut down at about $1.40, $1.50 a gallon because you're at break even, and you can't lose money forever before you have to shut down a plant. Well, if you can make another 70% more ethanol and do it at $1.03 a gallon, then how more competitive is your corn to ethanol plant? Now, this new technology doesn't influence at all your current ethanol plant because all it does is take the off gas off the fermenters and convert it to more ethanol. Now, this is what I'd like to see people get behind and develop this further and prove it all out, because this is something that can help Iowa. Because can you imagine telling Washington, D.C., we can produce another 70% more ethanol, but we don't have to use any more corn? I mean, before long, all these lunatics that are trying to harm Iowa and the farmers are put back in a basket saying these farmers in Iowa have more knowledge about technology than all the people east of the Mississippi River.
I can't wait to where that happens, let me tell you. I think you hit on a bigger, broader point here, that if you have a marketplace, the investments in new technologies will follow. And I think many of you know, if you've been to our website, we've got a collaboration ongoing with Ricardo Engineering, which is one of the top automotive engineering companies in the world. And they're developed what they call an ethanol boost direct injection engine. It's 3.2-liter gasoline engine, V6 turbocharged, twin turbocharged, and it replaces a 6.7-liter diesel engine. They're going to have two of these pickups out on the road by the end of the year, but it weighs 40% less weight, the engine does, and it costs $4,000 less than the comparable diesel engine. But that's the type of examples that you'll see if we have a market and if investors believe there's a marketplace for more ethanol. That's why the blend wall and these infrastructure things are so important. America is innovative, and they're very innovative when it comes to making money. Farmers are the best entrepreneurs in the world, you know, the most productive society. Unleash the industry and watch what happens. You know, how many people ever thought we'd be producing 13 billion gallons of ethanol back in the gasoil days when we, you know, first started? Nobody thought it could happen. They can. And these guys are all a tribute to it. You mentioned the environmental benefits. No one gives us credit, and I'm sure Bill's been to a bunch of these plants. I've been to Rick's plant in Chancellor, where they've tapped into the landfill. They're burning methane, and Joel may be doing the same stuff with wood waste. All these ideas and innovations will follow, and they weren't forced to do these things. These were innovations to help their efficiency, and you know, we just saw USDA's latest report, energy efficiency. Ethanol keeps getting better. Water efficiency, it keeps getting better. You name it, we've not reached our capacity. And you point out a good point.
Now, let me, too, add, certainly we've seen a lot of changes in the last 10 years. These plants are only, in many cases, 5 years old. And this industry of a scale like we're looking at it is really less than 10 years old. To be able to see all the changes, to look at those efficiencies, the water recycling that's being done, the spinning off of oil, all kinds of different things, new energy sources in some of these facilities as well. So this isn't just predicting future efficiencies. This is allowing the current desire to find new and different things to be able to happen to these plants. They need the predictability a policy that tells these plants that this industry is going to be around for a while, and these are the rules that you have to live by in the next few years. We need a predictable future for these plants to be able to know and invest. Most of these efficiencies cost some money to put into place. And to be able to know that you're going to get that money back and you're going to pay for those efficiencies, you got to have some predictability in the future. And those are the decisions that need to be made in the next 3 or 4 months.
All right, we have time for one last question before we go to the one-on-ones. Anybody have a question? This is your last shot. Last call. Okay, thanks. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.